Support for WPR comes from Doulaing the Doula. With birth and postpartum training and certification programs for all levels of learning, from medical professionals to interested humans. More is at doulaworkshop.com.
I didn't have a date or anything, so I and this friend of mine, Mal Brossard, on the wrestling team, decided we'd take a bus into Eggerstown and have a hamburger and maybe see a lousy movie, and neither of us felt like sitting around on our asses all night. I asked Mal if he minded if Ackley came along with us. And the reason I asked was because Ackley never did anything on Saturday night except stay in his room and squeeze his pimples or something. Mal said he didn't mind, but he wasn't too crazy about the idea. He didn't like Ackley very much. The best fictional description of adolescence and their peer relationships may be J.D. Salinger's Catcher in the Rye, the sad and funny narrative of a failing prep school student by the name of Holden Caulfield. But there are some real concerns out there when it comes to peer relationships for adolescents. I'm Norman Gilliland. Adolescence is a difficult and sometimes dangerous time of transition. My guest, Amy Belmore, has done extensive research into what can make those teen years more manageable. She works as a professor of human development in the Department of Educational Psychology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
When we look at the difficulties of adolescent peer relationships, are we going to be informing the adolescents or their teachers and parents?
It's a great question. So I think the adolescent themselves are the experts. They understand all of the complexities. And I feel like the adults want to have an understanding of maybe why it looks so difficult. But actually, there are a lot of rewards happening during this time and reasons that things happen that have good outcomes as well. So in my teaching position, and actually probably also from the scholarship perspective, I am focusing on informing adults about the whys these happen. And a lot of the time I'm thinking of teachers in mind because I teach future secondary education teachers. And they talk about what they see in their classrooms with respect to social relationships. So I think people can take different approaches, but certainly I've focused more on informing adults about these processes.
And these adults don't remember their own experiences as adolescents and can't apply that to their experience with their younger charges?
I think they do remember. And I also think, so this actually gets back to your first question, I think even if we remember, we don't know all of the reasons for why things happen, or we don't know all of the ways to make sense of them, even from an adult perspective. But I also think what happens in today's classrooms is people realize a lot of things are very different in the social lives and the, you know, bigger environment of school in modern times than compared to their experiences.
Do you want to go through some of those differences before we look into some of the components of these peer relationships?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, almost at a sort of basic level, population sizes are bigger, right? So classrooms are bigger, schools are bigger in most places. But also certainly technology. So, you know, the impact of social media, but also the way technology is used in teaching. I think those are, you know, some of the main changes.
Are there classrooms where students actually are required to check their cell phones as they enter the room?
There are. And I don't know about the individual differences, but I just a couple weeks ago was at our conference, Society for Research and Child Development, and I met with a colleague there who's in Australia, and they have a complete smartphone ban for kids. I'm not sure the exact age, if it's under 18, but it's like not just a school-wide, but sort of national.
So the students actually have to resort to passing notes?
Maybe. I think they will find the ways that it has to be done the same way we did. But yeah, I'm not sure what the strategies will be that they employ, but I know that they'll find a way to connect.
Has popularity changed? The whole, let's say, mechanism for becoming popular? Or is it even as important as it used to be?
I do think it is as important as it used to be. So, and I don't think the mechanisms have changed. So one of the things that we know is across the adolescent years in particular, so from middle school through high school, if we think about it in framing it in school ages, popularity and the desire to be popular is sort of the most important to youth early in their adolescence, so in the middle school years. And it sort of increases a bit throughout middle school. And then its importance to their lives declines. But when I say that, I need to point out that there are two ways that we think of popularity. And this gets back to that distinction between the way that youth might experience it and the way that adults do, so who aren't in the midst of it. And that's to say we distinguish between something we call sociometric popularity or acceptance, which is being well-liked, as sort of the broader meaning of the word popular, and then something that some people call perceived popular, which is the notion of being visible and powerful, that isn't necessarily associated with being well-liked. Sometimes can be, but isn't. And it's that, actually, it's the second one, the perceived popular, that youth sort of seek more than being well-liked.
Well, if you're in a high school class with 600 other people, say, wouldn't it be almost impossible to be perceived universally as powerful and therefore popular? Wouldn't you have to rely, as adolescents have done for generations, on your own little group and to be popular within that group?
That's really interesting. So certainly in these larger contexts, so students do sort of divide themselves into these different groupings, and status and the pursuit of popularity is relevant in those smaller groups, but it also still is relevant in the bigger group. And you're right that it is very difficult to achieve that status. And I think a lot of people talk about the status that someone might achieve there as reputation-based, like just the idea that this person is popular. This happens when I teach about this. I try to think of a celebrity who is, you know, someone that we all know, right? And I get into trouble if I name someone that maybe not everybody agrees, like, oh, we all know that person. Which is interesting because I feel like it shouldn't be that hard to do. It's much harder to do also with finding someone that everybody says is well-liked. So that popularity happens within the smaller groupings, but also in the larger grouping.
I have seen somewhere that, let's say, whether it's a village or Facebook or whatever it might be, that about 150 is the maximum number of peers directly that anybody can deal with anyway.
So I've seen different numbers where they've done these analyses. These are sort of they're not quite studying the entire population, but large populations, thousands and thousands, sometimes hundreds of thousands, and creating social networks to understand how people are connected. And you're right, there is sort of a maximum number that is meaning in terms of meaningful relationships, people that you actually know or are connected to. And that number gets even smaller when you think about something that you might actually call a friendship. It's the sort of required number for that, and predicting adjustment is much smaller. So yes, it is hard to navigate a huge social network and a whole population, something like a grade in a high school or even the whole high school.
So if I'm a high school sophomore coming into town for the first time, beginning new school, new teachers, new associates and all that, how do I go about becoming popular?
Well, so I would say the first thing is to do is to observe, to get the lay of the land in many ways, and to see what are the norms in that context. So that's one of the important things about popularity and the pursuit of it and also the achievement of it. I'm not sure if it's actually required for the maintenance of it, and we could talk about that if we want to, but certainly for acquiring it, you have to fit in the way that is meaningful in that context. So in one high school context, it might be through academics, actually. That might be the way to achieve it. In another, it might be athletics. And in another, it might be just the way you dress. And so sort of taking into account what are the, you know, the factors that lead to popularity is sort of like step one. And that's really easy for me to say as an adult who doesn't have a stake in it, like, you know, who's trying to achieve that popularity. Also with someone who's, you know, my brain is more developed, so I'm not like as quick to rush into things. But honestly, that would be the good strategy.
It seems that actually it's much harder to be, I'll say, famous and therefore popular if you're an academic star than if you're an athletic star, where you might have several hundred people watching you.
That is true. So one of the, so it like the factor about that that actually differentiates those two you highlighted, that one of them gets much more attention than the others. And that is actually, yeah, the thing that leads to that visibility. So it's not sort of on the merits of what the activities are. It's really about being aware of it. Yeah.
What about my appearance?
Appearance plays a huge role in popularity. I know maybe it's not something that we want to hear, but it's actually quite true. So I always think about for this perceived popularity, there are a lot of A words associated with it. So athleticism is one of them. Appearance is another one. Affluence also is another one.
Affluence.
Yeah. So things that make you visible. And so in the case of a high school, that might be, again, style of dress, or you have a car and nobody else does, these kinds of things that indicate that.
Not much you can do about that, is there?
There really isn't. So this is why this, you know, the attention to the norms is important, but there is an element of social skillfulness that comes into play that will allow you to maybe create connections. So maybe you don't have these qualities, but you can connect with people, you know, the individuals in the high school who do, and create those friendships and maybe sort of acquire the status in that way.
Well, yes, you mentioned your sociability, I'll call it,
yep,
which might even start with the ability to remember people's names.
Yep. Yeah. There's a whole host of social skills that are really fundamental to that, to creating any kind of connection. And that's why when I started off by saying just sort of being aware, like paying attention to the environment and using that is something that's useful.
Can you buy popularity if I come to school with treats or something?
I don't think so. Although I don't know anybody who's done that study, actually. Yeah, I don't know if that's a quick pathway there. I'm not sure.
That could be a fun one to study. So how about once I become popular, reasonably popular, what do I have to do to maintain that?
Yeah, so that actually brings up another A that I didn't mention, and this is maybe the one that sort of gives us the most problem from an adult perspective, and that is aggression. So it doesn't have to be physical aggression. It can be what we call relational or social aggression, things like excluding people or gossiping and telling rumors. And these kinds of strategies, so there is research that shows that the perceived popular youth are more aggressive, and they also really, the group who is the most aggressive are those right under the top tier. So those who are like, they're popular, but they're not the most popular and they want to stay there. And so they employ these strategies. And we also see that friends do this together. So you know, it makes sense that popular people are friends with each other, but also there's this similarity in the extent to which they use aggression and who they target within their school.
It must be some targeting, though, even in that upper echelon.
There is. And there is also amongst each other. So, you know, there's a lot that goes on, and we have many movies about this, sort of the strategizing for moving into these top roles. Where they're not just targeting the lower status, they're targeting each other to stay there or to overcome each other. Yeah.
Do we see, just jumping ahead for a second here, if we go to the 10th high school reunion. Do we see changes in those earlier aggressive students? Do they mellow out?
They do. So I think a really important thing, so I frame this as, you know, this is troubling to us as adults, especially teachers working in that environment. If you're the parents of these kids, you're worried that their child might be labeled as aggressive. But the truth is, yes, it does not mean that they will be an aggressive adult. It is not a clear pathway to that. So one thing that happens is the importance of popularity wanes across those years, as I talked about, but also the strategies for having high status change as you move into adulthood. There are different things that you need to do to acquire status in the different environments that you're working in that aren't the same for what happens in high school. So strategically, people just move out of those. But also the brain development that I talked about is important because people can resist impulses and not need to be aggressive in ways they might have in younger years.
But surely a lot of these students who go into school hoping to be popular at some point, often fairly early, realize they're not going to be popular with everybody. How do they adjust?
So not being popular is just fine. That's actually most of us. We call it in the research literature, quote unquote, average. Like that's the grouping. That is 65% of the student population.
Not popular.
Right. And it's fine. It is the norm. It is there is no sort of negative adjustment associated with it if we look at academics or psychological or social adjustment. And also, it doesn't predict any great positive outcomes either. It really is the norm and average.
Would we expect that 65% to be more empathetic than the ones who are climbing to the top of the social ladder?
That's a really interesting question. I don't know that people... Actually, they probably have studied it, but I don't know what the research suggests about that. But I do know that the group that is well-liked, so that version of popularity, they are more empathetic than all other students, including the average students. So there is, and we, so I won't say the collective, we all say me and my group, we think of empathy as a social skill. So and being socially skilled is the thing associated with being well-liked and well-accepted.
How do grades correlate with popularity?
There is an association, but for that kind of perceived popularity, the kind we've mostly been talking about, it's unclear. So it's sort of all over. So some do better in school and some do worse and some are average. So when you look at it, then in a study, you might not find an association because you really need to look at different groupings and there will be like different behavioral factors or friend factors that might account for why some groups do better and some groups do worse. For being likable, it is associated with better grades. That's a clear association. And we haven't talked, so you asked about sort of the everybody group, but there is another group that is sort of at risk for not doing well in school, and that's what we call rejected youth. So youth who, it's a really small part of the population, but they're an important group. It's just groups that everybody sort of decides we don't like that kid. And again, it's quite small within any setting, but those students are at risk for having lower grades.
What tend to be the characteristics of those rejected kids?
So this is going to be confusing because I just said about the perceived popularity that they're aggressive. These youth also are aggressive, but it's a different kind of aggression. So with the perceived popular youth, it's sort of a strategic aggression that it gets employed in certain ways. They know who to target and when. For the rejected youth, it's more sort of a dysregulated aggression, and they might lash out at people who they shouldn't lash out at. And use these aggressive behaviors in places where they might get in trouble or they disturb others. So that's one of the qualities. They also are less likely to have friends. So maybe, you know, they don't have people who can inform them about when they should do these things.
Well, let's talk about friendship when we return. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Amy Belmore. She has done extensive research into adolescence and adolescent peer relationships. And we've looked a lot, probably not enough, at popularity and the role that it plays in adolescent life and the maladjustment or adjustment thereof. But getting down to the core of not looking at the whole high school population for popularity, but to our individual friendships, in a way, maybe you're most vulnerable in that context.
Yeah, I would say that's a really nice way to frame it. And I think the vulnerability is something that allows you to acquire the social skills that you need in all other kinds of relationships throughout the rest of your life. Because you feel safe with these people. There's a trust that you start to acquire in the adolescent years in friendships that we talk about the development of trust and intimacy in adolescent friendships as sort of a new experience relative to the kind of friendship experiences that you have in childhood. So that's something that actually does distinguish them.
Really, what is that distinction?
Well, so I think this also relates to this sort of brain development that I referred to earlier, this ability to take into account other people's perspectives. So a new understanding that, you know, the way that I experience the world, my wants and needs might differ from someone else's. And now this is a person that I like and I want to experience things with. Maybe, you know, we're on the soccer team together and I want to achieve certain things with this person, but I also recognize, oh, they experience the world differently. And so I learn to evaluate, like, can I express my true self with them? Are they going to understand that? Should I hold back? Have I expressed something and then they revealed that to other people? They, you know, betrayed my trust. And those kinds of experiences, sort of that understanding of the other is something different than childhood. So in childhood, you're on the soccer team, you're playing together, but you aren't necessarily sort of conceiving of all of these ways that you each are experiencing that same experience.
So you're referencing at one point there, I tell a secret to my best friend and suddenly it gets spread around.
Yep. Yeah, so this happens, certainly. And, you know, it could relate to the motivations that we talked about earlier with respect to popularity. It could relate to motivations for people wanting to feel more secure within certain friendships. There are a lot of dynamics involved, and the adolescents themselves become aware of these and use these strategically. So when we talk about social skills, we talk about a lot of really positive things, like, but there also is this awareness that you can use them strategically.
How common is it in these, I'll say, junior high school years, to have a stable, reliable friendship between the sexes?
So this, I don't know the exact statistics, but it actually has been studied. So one of the things that's really clear is that in our elementary school years, we are sex segregated in our relationships, in our friendships in particular. We really play mostly with same-sex peers. And that starts to diminish in the middle school years and sort of continues where we become much more integrated in terms of how we interact and we create these bigger peer groupings. And I'm sure there is data on exactly like who people choose sort of as their best friend, or we oftentimes in our work use the term closest friend rather than best friend, just because it gives a broader meaning to it. But so I don't know for sure in terms of like opting into an other sex peer for that, but I'm sure someone knows.
Well, then I also have to ask, about sex in general at this age and the effects that it generally has on the participants?
I think so. There are different theories about sort of how, like, how we how we experience the different kinds of relationships we've talked about. So even the notion of status and friendship, that these relate to the idea of sort of the individual experiences that people have, the dyadic experiences. So friendships as sort of something that then leads into dating relationships and romantic relationships, but also within these broader groups, the group-based experience. So the notion of these sort of dyadic relationships or couples within the broader group. So there are theories about sort of that these are connected and that each is sort of laying the groundwork for learning about the next, like, kind of relationship, or really it's like an addition of new relationships into our lives.
Yeah, but it sounds like it could be a catastrophe, too, if you're unfamiliar, which obviously everybody would be the first time around with this kind of relationship, that miscalculation is quite possible.
Well, so catastrophe, that's a big word. I mean, I think this gets back to, like, this is the norm. Like, they're all negotiating this. They are all moving through these relationships together, right? Like, they're all experiencing it and trying to make sense of it. And there are no rules. There is no, like, guidebook. Like, this is how to do it. This is what should happen. And we all move through development. So I don't know that I, certain individual experiences might feel like they're catastrophes, but I don't know that I would characterize it that way.
You said early on, Amy, that most of the slant on your research has to do with teachers or adults. So how would you apply that to these friendship relationships?
I think a thing that I try to do in my work and interactions with future teachers is I don't want to overemphasize the importance of these social relationships in that context, but I want them to be aware of how important these are to the youth themselves. And you mentioned earlier that shouldn't we all know that? We all live through this, right? As adults, like, we know what it felt like. And the answer is yes, but we forget, because we have different rewards and different pursuits that we are moving towards as adults. And different things have become meaningful and replaced those things. But for the youth at that time period, they're really attending to that. And so I like for teachers to know, and there are individual differences in the ways that adults, different teachers are going to emphasize or attend to these social relationships, but I at least want them to be aware that this matters a lot to the students themselves.
We may touch on this again a little later, too, in a slightly different context, but inevitably we have to talk about social media when we talk about friendships. Can social media become a substitute for a real flesh and blood friendship for somebody who's socially awkward?
So the short answer is I'm going to say probably. I think so. This has been the domain of communications researchers and psychologists for sure, not just those, but at least those two groups coming at it from different angles, thinking about, like, can there be sort of a compensatory way that social media works, and or does it harm these relationships that we, these sort of offline relationships that we might have, or do they supplant them in some way that might be negative? So people sort of come at this from different angles. And I think there's, so the reason I said probably is I think there is some evidence that for some sort of individuals who might feel awkward or might need more time to think about how to interact with people, that they can benefit from these online relationships, that some of the, you know, security built in of the time lag between interactions or the screen or a different population, right? So one of the things that's unique about social media is you aren't constrained by your school population, and you have access to people that you might have real close shared interests with, and you can create bonds in that way. So yes, I do think actually social media could work to create friendships that are just as meaningful and contribute to our social development in the same ways that offline ones do.
You have to wonder a little bit about the role that AI is going to play in that, though.
I worry about the role. And I'm not like an alarmist about technology in general. But it is in my brain as something to think about, but I have not figured out what it means or how it will impact these experiences. It is for sure something that people who do what I do need to be attending to, though. Yes.
I have noticed that often social media in the form of a cell phone is a way to avoid eye contact.
Yeah, I think I don't know that individuals are opting into that like as the strategy. It might just be that they're so like into what it is that's happening there. But also, I think people do talk about that, right? Like going to places and you don't want to talk to anybody, so you can become involved with the phone. But that kind of question, sort of how adolescents use it and whether or not they're doing that with phones. We don't ask them. We haven't gotten to the point where we get into these like finer grade details. We've really focused on just like, are they using it at all and how much are they using it and what are they doing there and who are they connecting with? But there's a lot of nuance that needs to be investigated for sure.
How much are they using it?
They're using it a lot. So when I started, I didn't attend to social media in my own scholarship until 2011, which sounds, I don't know if that sounds like a long time ago or recent, but I really kind of, I wasn't ignoring it. I knew it was a factor, but it wasn't essential to the work that I was doing looking at adolescent peer relationships. But then I became aware, I really need to look at this as a space where they are. And over time, so I say this because I'd write these articles and I would say, like, here's the statistic that the Pew Research Organization has done. Like, this is the percentage that are opting into social media, or this is the amount that they're on their phone. And literally for the past 3 years, the statistic is like 100%. So they are all there. They are all, using phones. It's we still need to say it because we need to know it and it might change. But it is ubiquitous in their lives.
Well, to be fair, just the phone itself, there's a long tradition of long conversations between friends, same gender, different genders, on the phone.
Yes. Yeah. So, and I think the people, so I come to the study of thinking about social media from the point of view of I'm interested in the social relationships, but the scholars who work in the space of thinking about how these media and technology innovations impact our human experience, they come to it from the point of view of models and theories that they've developed about the sort of experiences of particular forms of media and how things like, a wired phone differs from a phone that you take everywhere and a phone that gives you access to the whole world. Yes.
We're going to get more into the subject of social media and also the subtopic, I guess you would say, of bullying and other phenomena having to do with social media when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Amy Belmore, a researcher in the field of adolescent peer relationships. And we've gotten a lot into the concept of popularity and into notions and experiences with friendship. And we have touched on a phenomenon that comes up in the news a lot these days, often in tragic contexts, and that's bullying.
Yes. And I think that's also the context in which I started studying it and the reason that I did. So I did my dissertation work a really long time ago in this area because there were these sort of really devastating newsworthy events showing the harm that bullying causes. And in the time, the 20 years that I've been studying it since then, the data are very clear that it is very harmful to those involved, both the people who perpetrate it and the people who are victimized or targeted by it.
There's, of course, a long, I use the word, tradition of bullying. It's, in a way, I suppose, it's kind of this effort to scramble to the top by putting somebody else down.
Yeah, so it relates to a lot to what we talked about, the notion of popularity. So the way that those of us who work both in scholars trying to as scholars who try to understand it and as scholars who try to intervene and prevent it and prevent the harm from it, we all attend to sort of we frame it as a group-based phenomenon and a sort of contextual-based phenomenon that everybody in a given context is relevant to it happening or not happening or the impact of it. So that does relate to these sort of status hierarchies and the pursuit of it and what we value in terms of then allowing the sort of achievement of popularity. And so, you know, I mentioned that aggression is a part of that. And so that has been the case for all of the years that we've been studying it, and it hasn't gone away. We haven't been able to change that as a feature that allows for it. So you're right, it relates a lot to the idea of hierarchies.
Is there a distinction between bullying one-on-one versus group-on-one?
That is interesting. I haven't heard it asked in that way. What I would say is both qualify as bullying, and the distinction might be the motivation of the bully. So in the group context, it might be more about fitting in with your friends. So it also relates to this sort of friendship idea that you sort of target certain kind of people. In the one-on-one dynamic, I think a lot of the way it gets portrayed a lot of times in media, so both books and movies, is sort of a one-on-one kind of thing. Like there's a dynamic between a bully and a victim. I actually think that maybe misrepresents it, again, because of this sort of, it's really a group-based phenomenon. Like, people are aware that that's happening, that, you know, if we want to call them bystanders or witnesses, people know that this is happening. I'm saying that because I think even in that one-on-one dynamic, it still is about a connection to the bigger group and wanting to be perceived in some way.
Well, I suppose just if the witnesses of the bullying, though not actively participating, are passively allowing, then the effect is much the same?
It is. So there is a lot of work looking at that, and a lot of work trying to change the behaviors of those who are just witnessing and sort of letting it happen. And it's not to say that they are responsible for it or, you know, that this is their charge, but the idea is that there's sort of safety in that if everybody steps up and says this is not okay and lets the bully know they're not going to get the rewards that they seek, and lets certainly a really important feature is letting the targets of the bullying know that it is wrong what they experience, that it is not about them, that they are not at fault for being the target of it. Yes.
What kind of recourse does that target of the bullying have, though? I mean, if he goes to some authority figure and complains, then doesn't that just make things worse for him or her?
I think so. I think that's a complicated question. I think the evidence is mixed. So I will certainly hear a lot of anecdotes about things like that where it's gone wrong when a student has reported something, and it might be reporting it to a friend, to a teacher, or to an authority figure in the school, or a parent. Certainly parents are important here. And then nothing happens, or they get in trouble, like, because that can happen, right? So if you're fighting back against something or standing up against it, you might be the one who gets identified as, involved in the situation, even if you didn't cause it. So, however, the evidence is really clear that pursuing help and asking for help is better than not. So people have to become aware of it. And even if it's not the first person that you think will step in and help you, eventually you will find the person who will help you. And, you know, this it sort of troubles me because it sounds like, the burden's on the target, like they're searching for the answer. And that is not what I intend it to be. But what I would want to know is, like, I would want the targets to know there is hope, that there are people who will step in. And sometimes people don't, just because they literally don't know that it's happening. And so making people know is the first step.
If I'm a teacher, then how do I respond to a bullying situation? Would that depend a little bit on how I'm made aware of it?
Yes. So our data, we have some studies from middle school students that actually show quite clearly, even though I describe this as this group phenomenon and people are aware, that students are really selective in doing this out of teachers' viewpoints or vantage points. So teachers sometimes aren't aware that, like, actual events are happening. And also, so I think a really nice thing that has happened in the past, I would say 15 years or 10 years, certainly, we have schools attending to this as a really important issue. So they have policies in place, they're required. So actually every state in the United States has sort of K through 12 bullying laws on their books that direct schools, public schools, about what they need to do. And those are all varied in terms of what that needs to happen. But I say this because then teachers know sort of the steps that they should take, or that they have that resources that they have access to within their school. So it's not like teachers have the full burden of solving this either.
With a cell phone, though, the bullying can easily take place outside of school, even though it might involve classmates.
Yes, this makes it all super complicated. And that last part that you, the phrase that you said might involve classmates, is the research right now seems to suggest that those who are targeted in school are also those who are targeted out of school. That probably means that it's by the same people, that it is, there's some sort of connection there. I don't know what the sort of, you know, I think schools have different policies on sort of how they then deal with that. If it's not actively taking place in school, but does involve students within the schools, I don't know the solutions for that, but you're right, it adds a huge complicating factor.
I suppose a component of that, too, could be just commentary on the way that student might be a bad athlete, might not dress fashionably, that kind of thing. So not directly taunting that student, but commenting upon this student in social media?
Yeah, you're right. So the lines about the definition of bullying, right? So in my work, like we need a precise definition for these, you know, what we call them variables, right? Like, what is bullying? What is the actual definition? And that's important for our scientific measurement of it. But you are right. It actually is really important for our practical implications of it, for us to all understand, like, does this qualify? What is this actual behavior? So something like name calling actually is bullying, right? Like it satisfies it under certain conditions when there's an imbalance of power and if it's something that happens repeatedly. And so this sort of these examples that you gave that might be even a more blurry line where it's not direct, but it is someone calling out someone online, you know, the school or the individual themselves, whoever it is, who it's important for them to define what that is for themselves. So I say that because one of the things that's actually, this is something that I hold really true in my own scholarship, that the target of bullying defines it for themselves as if it's bullying or not. That it's really important to me that if they experience it in that way, then that's what it is. And the reason I say that is it's really clear that when they do that, it connects to certain outcomes, negative outcomes always. That's the requirement for me.
What sort of outcomes?
So we talked before about academic outcomes and targets of bullying. They have lower grades. They also have more absences from school. So they want to avoid school because it's some place that they're harmed. Unexcused absences, I should say. So, you know, it's a particular kind of absence. They also report more physical symptoms. So things like headaches and stomach aches. And I'm not saying those are psychosomatic. They might be sort of real physical experiences that they're having in reaction to it. And certainly they report sort of their psychological functioning is compromised. So more depressive symptoms, more social anxiety, greater loneliness. They don't feel like they belong in school as much.
A problem that is exacerbated somewhat with the ability of AI to disseminate falsified images of the person being bullied?
Yes. So I think this is, you know, I've seen a few, or colleagues have sent me these like news stories, things, events that have happened in different high schools of these kinds of things happening. So certainly, yes, that the new tools that youth have to bully each other, people are using these. And we as adults are behind in sort of, we can't stop it at this point, but being aware that this is happening, yes.
Let's go back full circle in a way. We're talking about adolescent peer relationships. And if I'm the new kid in school, or even if I've been there a long time and just nobody ever noticed me, how do I go about making friends?
Wow, that is, that if I knew the answer, I would make a little handbook, sell it on the internet. I mean, I think the best advice that I can give for that is, you know, it truly is like joining things, making the connections. So one of like a hallmark, the a like tried and true thing we know about friendships is that the way that they start, a fundamental requirement is spending time together, literally being near a person. And that could be online. So this is why I don't discount what happens online. But certainly, and so in a school context, so finding how what's the way that I can be near people. So one of those is through an activity that you enjoy, like, you know, following your true interests and joining that activity and then making friends in that context. If I think about my own, like who I'm connected to this day, 30 plus years out of high school, it was a lot of people with the last name B because we were seated next to each other.
Uh-huh.
Yes. So it literally was who I was next to, and I became friends with them, and I still am friends with them to this day. So that being near people and with people is like step one.
What's step two?
That's a great question. That part I don't know. I really do think there's an element of this sort of like being aware of the needs of others. So tapping into these skills that we are developing, like the ability to take into account perspectives and, you know, meeting those needs.
So actually just helping other people.
Helping, absolutely, is a huge part of friendship. Yes. Yep.
I would think a drawback with, let's say, Facebook and actually becoming good friends is it's kind of like a phone call in a way. You can't really tell everything that's going on in the environment. You can't really tell who's just right outside the screen.
Yeah, that's really interesting to think about that. Yes, that it's not private, that you can't fully know. And I think so. I think an interesting feature of that when I think about young people growing up in that reality is that they just have an intrinsic awareness of that is the case, right? That the things that you're communicating aren't private necessarily in the way that they are when you're face to face and you know you're the only two people in the room. I think I have the sense that they are aware that is the reality and then may alter their interactions as a result.
They value the realistic quality of an adolescent having a solid friend who is much older? Would that be a stabilizing force, or would that not be a realistic relationship?
So One of the things that we know about relationships is that, or peer relationships in adolescence, is that they are oftentimes of same age. That seems to be a feature of the school and the way that we group people by grades and ages. And, you know, the places that that breaks down is like on teams. So you might be really excellent at football. So you join the varsity team in ninth grade. Like, I don't know if that's a reality, but something like that. And there's a big gap. Those 4 years, that's a big
yes.
gap. And we don't because we group students in schools in this way, and because that's the traditional way that we have studied them, we understand them mostly through the point of view of interactions with like truly same age peers, like literally to the year. So I don't know about scholarship on relationships, sort of that bridge, you know. I don't even know what the idea you have of how big of a age gap there might be there.
Well, adult versus, you know, teenager.
Yeah, I think that I don't know of any work in that space, but I think a different but maybe related idea would be the notion of mentors.
Yes.
And having like non-family mentors, coaches is a really good example of that. But I don't think we wouldn't characterize those as friendships. I think they're quite different. Yeah.
Interesting, though, to again go to that high school reunion, however many years after the fact, and see how many friendships have lasted, and also how many marriages.
Yes, for sure. Interesting, and especially, I mean, in thinking about the current times that we live in, and how many people are getting married much later, so it's really unlikely that it's connected to their high school years in current times.
But that's true, although in previous years, when people did marry younger, and you would see these couples 30 years later met in high school.
Yep.
And it stayed.
Yep.
So overall, what would be your advice, Amy, for maintaining a peer adolescent relationship?
Oh my gosh, that's tricky. I think I always go back to this awareness of others. So certainly an awareness of self actually is primary in that.
Well, that's could be the tough part, though.
It is the tough part.
And it's thyself.
It is the hallmark of adolescent development, actually, according to a lot of people, sort of that development of identity. But I think recognizing that actually that knowledge of self actually also comes through knowledge of others. So to me, sort of they go hand in hand.
So it helps to have some kind of a value system to begin with and know how you would then respond to somebody else.
It really does. And your value system can change, right? Like in reaction to others as well. I think that's part of the growth. I mean, the developmental psychologist part of me really focuses on development, that change is possible and maybe should occur. Yeah.
There's certainly lots of changes occurring in adolescence. It's a very unstable time for a lot of people.
Yes, it's what makes it exciting.
It has been a really interesting glimpse into adolescent peer relationships. And thank you, Amy Belmore, for sharing your research, extensive research into that phenomenon.
Thank you.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Jeff Robbins, and this is University of the Air.